Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel teaches Messianic Judaism for all nations, and we would like to be your long-distance congregation. If you listen regularly at BethEmmanuel.org, consider supporting us with regular financial gifts and become a virtual member. Click on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org to learn more.
This week, I would like to properly introduce the book by asking the types of questions that I always ask about a piece of literature, particularly biblical literature. Here are the questions we should always have in mind whenever we are looking at a book of the Bible. Here are the questions: what, when, who, to whom, why. So I need your patience today. I have crammed a ton of research and reading into a few pages of notes, and I may go a wee bit long in my teaching today. And to some of you, I think this material will be frightfully tedious and boring. Some of you will enjoy it, because that's the kind of person you are. Some of you will not. But it's a necessary first step before we begin to formally study the epistle. So here's the questions again. What? When? Who? To whom? Why? We'll start at the top of the list. What? What is it? What kind of document are we looking at in the book of Hebrews? You know, the Bible contains different genres. It has legal material, historical narratives, poetry, prophecy, wisdom literature, apocalypse, gospel, to name a few. Oh, and of course, written correspondence that we call epistles. So this is a question of genre. What kind of book of the Bible is this that we're looking at, the book of Hebrews? When was it written? That matters because it helps us identify the historical context. Without historical context, we get lost very quickly. For example, if you read a copy of the Gettysburg Address, but you assumed that it had been delivered by the American president sometime in the 1960s, you would misinterpret its contents and come to some very misguided conclusions about exactly how long ago 420 years was. So, this is a critical question when we can answer it. When? Who wrote it? This is important because it helps us to know the author's perspective, his experiences, and his motivations. And a corollary question, which is also nice to answer when we can, if possible, is the question of province. From where did the author, where was the author when he wrote this? Sometimes it makes a difference. So this is a question of authorship. To whom was it written? This also helps. It helps establish interpretive context, if you know who the intended reader is, because it's not you. As we learned when we were studying the Epistle to the Galatians, you know, and that this is a problem. I think this is a problem that, you know, in the evangelical mindset, sometimes we just assume the Bible is like written to us. You know, this seems nice. You know, it's just like, what does God have for me today? You know, that sort of approach, which is great. And I, you know, that's wonderful spiritual approach to the scriptures. That's how we should be. But we have to remember that on a literal level, it's written to somebody else. So when we were studying the Epistle to the Galatians, what did we learn? We learned, you know, that was the most important piece to understand what was going on. Who was this written to? It also helps, when possible, to know where the recipient or the intended recipient, the intended reader, was located. So to where was it written is a corollary question. So this is a question of address. Finally, why was it written? If we can discover the occasion that inspired the author to take up a pen and write, we will have a key to interpret the overall message of the document, to unlock the document. Every piece of biblical literature, every piece of Bible, was originally written with a specific objective, a specific purpose, to address a specific concern or to resolve a specific conflict. None of the Bible writers sat down with the intention of writing a book of the Bible. They had contemporary situations in view that they hoped their words could address. So this is a question of occasion. Those are the questions. If we can answer these questions, we'll be in good shape for studying the Epistle of the Hebrews. Unfortunately, we can't. Not very well. It requires some guesswork to get to the bottom. As I mentioned last week, the big problem is that the Epistle of the Hebrews lacks a superscription. When you don't have a superscription like you would ordinarily have a superscription at the beginning of an epistle, you know, Paul, an apostle to the Gentiles, to the Ephesians, or something like that. When you don't have a superscription, you don't have an address, it forces us to make some educated guesses about authorship, date, and address. That's how it works with the epistles. So we have to do some Bible detective work. So think of yourself as, Sherlock Holmes or something today, as we're laying the groundwork for the Bible study that we're going to be doing for the next several months. We'll start with what kind of document is the epistle to the Hebrews? What kind of document is the epistle? What genre is the epistle to the Hebrews? I mean, if we put it that way, it sounds pretty obvious. It's an epistle, stupid. An epistle is a letter. It's an epistle to the Hebrews. It's obviously an epistle. It's a piece of ancient mail sent from someone to someone else. Obviously, the epistle to the Hebrews is an epistle. But the problem is, it's not quite that fast. There is a problem with this easy answer. The title, Epistle to the Hebrews, is traditional. Mostly a matter of inference. A name added by the early church. It does not read like an epistle at all until chapter 12, about halfway through chapter 12 and definitely in chapter 13. As I mentioned, it doesn't have a superscription like an epistle should. So let's go to the epistolatory part of the epistle. Back in chapter 13, I'll show you what I mean. Back in chapter 13 is where it really starts to sound like an epistle. It says in, I've got it here, chapter 13. This is why we think of it as an epistle. It starts in verse 18 where it says, the writer says in the first person, pray for us, for we are sure that we have a clear conscience, desiring to act honorably in all things. Something's going on there. I urge you the more earnestly to do this in order that I may be restored to you the sooner. And then if you skip down to verse 22 after that doxology, it says, I appeal to you, brothers, bear with my word of exhortation, for I have written to you briefly. You should know that our brother Timothy has been released, with whom I shall see you, if he comes soon. Greet all your leaders and all the saints. Those who come from Italy send you greetings. Grace be with all of you. This is the subscription. This kind of language makes it pretty obvious that we are dealing with an ancient piece of correspondence sent from the author to a distant place, which makes it an epistle. Like the subscriptions of the epistles of Paul, it closes up with a few personal notes, references to colleagues, and greetings. So we're definitely reading an epistle, except for one thing. An important thing, if you notice, our writer actually identifies the genre of the document himself. He says, I appeal to you, brothers, bear with my word of exhortation. That's what he said. What is a word of exhortation? All right, so maybe we'll come back here, but I want you to turn to Acts 13. I'll show you a word of exhortation. Turn to Acts 13. Beginning in verse 14, the word exhort means to incite by argument or advice, to make an urgent appeal, to convince. The English Standard Version says exhortation, but it's translating the Greek paraklesis, which can also mean encouragement, which is the way the English Standard Version will choose to translate it in the passage we're about to read. But it's the same word, beginning in the middle of verse 14 where it says, and on the Sabbath day, they went into the synagogue and sat down. After the reading from the law, that is the Torah, and from the prophets, that is the Haftarah portion, the rulers of the synagogue sent a message to them saying, brothers, if you have any word of paraklesis, Any word of exhortation or encouragement for the people, say it. And this is, of course, Paul now stands up and he gives a word of exhortation, which is a long sermon based on the text that they had just heard read from the Bema that day. And you have a summary of that sermon following in Acts chapter 13. So in the days of the apostles, here's how it went down. Synagogues conducted prayer services, of course, every day at the times of prayer. But on the Sabbath, they augmented the service with a public reading of Scripture, number one. And that would consist of the Torah portion and the number two, the Haftarah portion from the prophets. And then number three, a word of paraklesis, a word of teaching, exhortation. So in addition to the liturgical prayers, which you the Sabbath prayers, the Sabbath service consisted of, number one, a reading from the Torah. We call that parsha. Number two, a complimentary reading from the Haftarah, or from the prophets that we call Haftarah. And number three, a teaching, which we call drasha. And that was an expounding on the two readings that we had just heard. So this is exactly what we see here in this verse. Look at this. Paul visits this Galatian synagogue, Pisidian Antioch, and he demonstrates the same three parts of the service. Number one, it says, after the reading from the law, that is from the Torah, and number two, the prophets, the Haftarah. Number three, the rulers of the synagogue sent a message saying, if you have a word of exhortation, a word of encouragement, say it. So in his first epistle to Timothy, his disciple Timothy, the Apostle Paul gives him instructions for conducting services in the local messianic synagogue of Ephesus. And he says in 1 Timothy 4:13, and says, until I come, devote yourself to the public reading of Scripture, Torah, Haftarah, and to exhortation and teaching. So you see the same pattern there. Likewise, in the epistle to the Romans, he says, he writes, this is Romans 12, speaking of spiritual gifts, he says, having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them properly. If you have prophecy, in proportion to our faith. If service, in our serving. The one who teaches, in his teaching. The one who exhorts, in his exhortation. The one who contributes, in generosity. The one who leads, with zeal. The one who does acts of mercy, with cheerfulness. It's Romans 12, 6 to 8. So, we looked at a few examples. A word of exhortation is a drash, a drasha. It's a sermon on the biblical text that might be offered in a first century synagogue. In this case, a first century messianic synagogue. That's a good description, I think, of the Epistle of Hebrews. It doesn't read like an epistle. It reads like a rabbinic discourse. It fits very well with rabbinic literature, such as the Midrash, which is in itself, for the most part, simply transcriptions of teachings that the rabbis presented in academies and synagogues. So we have in the Epistle to the Hebrews not an epistle, but a first century synagogue discourse, an early messianic Jewish sermon, if you will. It does contain some salutations at the end, which are epistle-like in nature. But the author identifies the body of the document, that is Hebrews 1 through 12, as a sermon, a teaching, a word of exhortation. He's transcribed a sermon, such as a discourse that he might have delivered on a Sabbath someplace, and he has sent it to some community for their edification. This means that the discourse might have originally been written for the community to whom he sent it, or it might mean that he was sending them a discourse he had delivered in some other community. That makes it a little bit more confusing. But the point is, what is it? It's a word of exhortation. Nevertheless, I will refer to it as an epistle for the sake of convenience and tradition. So second, that's our first question. What word of exhortation? Second question, when was it written? When did our preacher preach this sermon? That's called the book of Hebrews. Well, the end date, we can put an end date, a terminus on that, because the earliest time we have a quotation from the book of Hebrews is in Clement of Rome's Epistle to the Corinthians, also known as the Epistle of First Clement, which he wrote about 95 Common Era, near the end of Emperor Domitian's life. So we know that the Epistle of Hebrews must have been written earlier than that in order to have a piece of it appear in First Clement. But we can be more precise than that, because there's internal evidence inside the epistle, and the internal evidence indicates that it must have been written while the temple was still standing, which is to say before 70 Common Era, 70 AD. How do we know? Because whenever the epistle mentions the temple or the priesthood or the sacrifices, which it does frequently, it does so in the present tense. For example, listen to this, Hebrews 8. You can look at it if you want, but I'm going to just read it to you. Hebrews 8, verses 4 and 5 say, "Here in this world are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things." Notice the present tense. They serve, they offer. This means the book was written while the temple was still functioning and the priesthood was still serving and offering. So it had to be written before 70 Common Era. Some scholars disagree with that conclusion, but I believe it is a sound conclusion. In fact, I think we can go even further. Even further, because the epistle makes no reference to the Jewish revolt or the war with Rome. Remarks that we would expect, given the subject matter of a fading temple ministry. If our writer knew about the Jewish war with Rome, I believe he would have felt compelled to make some comment, some allusion about it, but he makes none whatsoever to those riveting political circumstances. And that omission pushes the book a little earlier back to the mid-60s. You know, and I think we can go even earlier. If we get to the mid-60s, then if we get to the mid-60s, then we have to pull it before 64. Before 64, because, you know, 64 is the big fire of Rome that brings on the big Neronian persecution, which is a huge thing. And to write a book that's talking about standing up in the face of persecution and make no mention of the big persecution that's happening is unthinkable, especially when you mention Italians in it. Those from Italy send their greetings, and what just happened to the Italian believers in 64, unspeakable atrocities that happened to the Italian believers in 64, and he doesn't mention this. No, it's got to be before 64. You know, and that's pretty good. You know, I think we can't put it much earlier than that. It can't be more than a year or two earlier than that. So that creates a very narrow window. This date will help us interpret the epistle. I mean, think back to the early 60s. What were you doing? You know, listening to the Beatles, I suppose. And if you think the 60s, I like to say, were turbulent in the previous century, you should have been there during the 60s in the first century. The early 60s date of this epistle is going to help us reconstruct the context which occasioned its writing. We'll probably do that maybe next week. All right, so who wrote it? The answer is no one knows. Really, nobody, it's the big mystery of the New Testament. Nobody knows who, that's why we always say, the writer of the book of Hebrews, that's why I always say that. You never hear, I never say, the writer of the book of James, you know, you say, James, right? You say, the writer of the book of Hebrews, because nobody knows, it's anonymous. It's a big mystery. The early church was really puzzled. It's a big mystery. It almost didn't make it in the Bible. This was almost a B-side. It was almost cut. It was almost, you know, something that would have only been in the director's cut of the New Testament. You know, they wouldn't have seen it in the theatrical release because nobody knew who wrote it. You don't know who wrote it, then you don't know if it's like, if it was it an apostle. If it's not an apostle, do we put it out with the apostle, the apostolic writings? Does it really belong with the apostolic writings? If it wasn't an apostle, wrote it's a big mystery. It's anonymous, so to speak. Not that it wasn't anonymous when it was written. I'm sure the people who received the mail, they knew who wrote it. Probably had a return address on it, you know. So it wasn't anonymous when it was written. The author clearly thinks that the people reading it know who he is. Pray for me, you know, and that sort of thing. Hopefully I'll be there soon. But the early church didn't remember who was this that wrote this. They wanted it to be Paul. Some people really wanted it to be Paul. So they would, some early codices bundle it with Paul's letters. So you get like all Paul's letters and Hebrews as if it is, but it's not. We talked about this last week. It's not Paul. It's not Paul's style. It's not Paul's language. It's for one. How do we know? Well, for one thing, I mentioned this last week. It's written in very good Greek, not like Paul. Paul's ragtag Greek. It's not Greek is not Paul's first language. The theological concepts are not particularly Pauline either. Moreover, Paul considered himself to be an apostle to the Gentiles. Whereas the epistle to the Hebrews appears to be written to Hebrews. So, and there's other reasons, but this is one thing all scholars are unanimous on. Paul did not write this epistle. Nevertheless, it does appear that the epistle was written by someone who knew Paul. Someone in the Pauline circle, the Pauline orbit. For example, we saw he made a reference to Timothy. Well, who's Timothy? He says, you know, hopefully Timothy's been released. Hopefully you'll get here soon. He'll come with me if he does. You know, who's Timothy? Well, Timothy is Paul's chief disciple. Timothy was to Paul what Peter was to Jesus. Number one, disciple. What Spock was to Captain Kirk. So a close relationship with Timothy puts our writer into Paul's sphere of influence, right? The second century church writer, Origen, puts it this way. He says, he's writing about this very problem in his introduction to a book that is called Homilies on Hebrews, which unfortunately we no longer have, but we still have this quotation from it in Eusebius. He says, as for myself, if I were to state my own opinion about the question, I should say that the thoughts are the Apostle Paul's, but the style and composition belong to one who merely called to mind the Apostle's teachings, as it were, made short notes of what his master said. If any church, therefore, holds this epistle as Paul's, let him be commended for this also. For not without reason have the men of old time handed it down as Paul's. So what is Origen saying? Origen is saying, look, I know that most Christians believe that Paul wrote this, but I don't think so. I think somebody else wrote this who knew Paul and knew Paul's thoughts and kind of wrote like Paul. That's what he's saying. But if you want to believe Paul wrote it, good for you. That's what he's saying. And then he concludes it, and he says, but who really wrote the epistle? In truth, only God knows. Some early church writers had this tradition that Paul's colleague Luke, the doctor, wrote it. Or some there's another tradition that Clement of Rome, we'll look at that one, that Clement of Rome might have been involved in the composition. Modern scholars have speculated, Barnabas, Apollos, even Priscilla and Aquila. That's one's very popular. Ooh, maybe it's by Priscilla. Maybe this is the only book of the Bible written by a woman. That must be the truth because it's just so socially right on the mark with what we would like to believe in the modern era. But without a shred of evidence or ancient tradition to support these theories, then they can all be safely discarded as mere guesswork. Clement of Alexandria had a tradition that Paul's traveling companion Luke wrote the epistle by translating it from an Aramaic document originally composed by Paul. Well, that was his theory. The problem with this tradition, with this theory, is that the Greek doesn't sound like Luke. We know Luke's Greek pretty well from the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. Nor does it betray any hint of Semitisms, of being a translation from an Aramaic or Hebrew original whatsoever. The 4th century bishop of Caesarea, Eusebius, whom I'm quoting all the time, and you hear that name over and over, Eusebius this, Eusebius that, he wrote the first real great history of early Christianity called ecclesiastical history. He cites an alternative tradition which fingers Clement of Rome as responsible. And that's interesting to me. Who is Clement? Clement of Rome, not Clement. I mentioned Clement of Alexandria. You got to remember, there's a lot of guys named Clement. But this is, when it's Clement of Rome, that's Peter's number one disciple. A Roman believer who followed Peter but also had contact with Paul. Paul refers to him as one of his fellow workers in Philippians 4:3, assuming that it's the same Clement. There are a lot of guys named Clement, but I like to think it is the same Clement. And according to tradition, Clement was Peter's chief disciple. He was to Peter what Timothy was to Paul. What Peter was to the master. You know, what Luke was to Obi-Wan. His number one student. The bishop, Eusebius, puts it this way. He says, others claim that it was Clement himself. This seems more probable because the epistle of Clement and that to the Hebrews have a similar character in regard to style, and still further because the thoughts contained in the two works are not very different. Modern scholars disagree with that assessment. They agree that the style sounds similar and at points identical, but they disagree when Eusebius says the thoughts are not very different. Modern scholars explain that instead, Clement was imitating the style of the epistle to the Hebrews, but they object that the theology is completely different. Why? Because whereas the book of Hebrews teaches a cancellation of the temple and the sacrificial system, the epistle of Clement to the Corinthians regards that system as a worthy model for emulation in respect to ecclesiastical authority. So on this basis, scholars say that the same writer could not have written both. The same brain could not have produced both. One holding the temple up as a worthy model for emulation, and the other saying that the temple had been canceled and replaced. I disagree because I don't read the Epistle of Hebrews as saying that the temple was canceled and replaced, and the Levitical system was canceled. So far as I'm concerned, Clement of Rome is the most likely candidate. I believe his authorship is backed up by a strong historical tradition, as Eusebius says. The style matches, the thoughts are similar. I would go with Clement if I had to choose one, but we don't know. That's just guesswork. Even if it wasn't Clement of Rome, though, we can say this. It had to be someone just like him. Someone very much like Clement. Let me explain. First of all, we know the writer is not an apostle. He's not. He's not an apostle. How do we know this? He's not one of the master's original disciples. How do we know this? Because he says so. He says in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 1, he says, the message was first declared by the master, and it was attested to us by those who heard. In other words, we weren't one of those who heard. It was attested to us by them. This means he's a second-generation believer. Yet at the same time, he writes like an apostle, like someone who has authority, and he transmits pure apostolic tradition. For example, he says this. This is one of my favorite verses. He's talking about Jesus, and he says, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears. That's an eyewitness report. Something our author obtained from one of the master's original disciples, such as Simon Peter, but not something that he himself experienced. So the writer of the epistle to the Hebrews speaks with apostolic sounding authority that we would not expect from a second generation disciple unless he was of distinguished rank, well recognized as an authority among the believers, and that could describe Simon Peter's chief disciple. So, I'm not saying it's Clement of Rome, but I'm saying that if it was not Clement, it was someone just like Clement. a second-generation disciple who speaks with apostolic authority and comes from the Pauline circle and knows believers from Italy. Clement of Rome, those from Italy. You see what I'm saying? Anyway, this is what he said. He said, those who come from Italy send you greetings. So, to whom was it written? We're just going to leave that. We're going to say it could have been Clement. To whom was it written? Next question. The epistle to the Hebrews. Duh. To the Hebrews, right? I mean, come on. In other words, Jewish people. To the Jewish people? To Jewish people? Well, the contents of the epistle make that pretty obvious. Unlike the epistles of Paul, which are written primarily to Gentile believers, this is more like the epistle of James, in that it addresses Jewish believers in Yeshua. It scarcely even mentions Gentiles. I'm not sure it does. It assumes a readership with sophisticated biblical literacy. That's what makes it so difficult. A very sophisticated biblical literacy and a familiarity with midrashic and rabbinic argumentation. And we've already determined that it is a word of exhortation to a messianic Jewish assembly or synagogue. So that's enough to go on. We can proceed. But we can be a little bit more specific. I think we can. Yes. We also know that they speak Greek. That they are Greek-speaking Jews. Probably not Galileans then, like the family of the master or disciples from Capernaum, unless they came from, well, they could have been Galileans. I mean, you had a lot of Greek-speaking Jews in Galilee, but these probably aren't. These are Hellenist Jewish believers, more like Stephen or Philip, the deacon. Most scholars today believe that the epistle must have been written to a community of Greek-speaking Jewish believers in the city of Rome. Why Rome? Well, again, because Hebrews 13:24 says, those who come from Italy send you greetings. So why would people from Italy know people? I mean, why would they send greetings? They obviously know each other. It's like, hey, remember us? We're from Italy. Send greetings. So maybe it was written to a community in Rome. It's a very large Jewish population. I think, let's see, we had largest Jewish populations outside of the land of Judea. Start with Antioch. Antioch has the largest population. No, Alexandria. Alexandria, Egypt. Largest Jewish population outside the land of Judea. Then Antioch. Antioch up in Syria. Second largest. Rome, third largest. So very large, very, very, very possible. Jewish believers. City of Rome could be. Could be. You could, perhaps it was written to a community in Rome. But I think the evidence is thin. Because the Greek that says, those who are from Italy send you greetings, could just as easily be read, those of Italy send you greetings, implying that it was not written to Rome, but from Rome. Moreover, several aspects of the contents do not make sense for a community in Rome. The whole discussion about the temple, the priesthood, and sacrifices would not be terrifically relevant to a community of Roman Jews because they had no access to those privileges in the first place, most of them having never even been to Judea, much less the temple in Jerusalem. For example, listen to this verse from chapter 13. In verse 9, he says, it is good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by foods, which have not benefited those devoted to them. We have an altar from which those who serve the tent, that is the holy place, have no right to eat. The concern in this cryptic verse is a contrast between sacrificial food, sacrificial meats and breads obtained from the temple and the priesthood in Jerusalem. A contrast between that and participation in Messiah. This argument would not be relevant in Rome. This argument would only be relevant to believers who actually were accustomed to eating from the sacred portions in Jerusalem. This is the only place you can eat that. And those sacred foods can only be obtained in the temple, which is only in Jerusalem. So, on this verse and others like it, I suggest that we are writing to a Judean community of Greek-speaking Jews living in Jerusalem or in Judea. And this finds support in the words where it says, he writes to them, he says in verse 12, he says, Jesus also suffered outside the gate of Jerusalem in order to sanctify the people through his blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. So here's the question then. Was there such a community? Was there a community of Greek-speaking Jewish believers in Jerusalem? Well, according to the book of Acts, there was such a large Greek-speaking community of Jewish believers in Jerusalem that the apostles had to appoint 7 Greek-speaking deacons just to manage them. And they hung out at a synagogue called Synagogue of the Freedmen, which was a Greek-speaking synagogue in Jerusalem. Now, all of this, you have to realize this is all educated guesswork, but I'm suggesting Jerusalem, or at least Judea, such as the Philip, you know, the deacon, his community in Caesarea. That would work even, because you would have access to the temple from Caesarea. Makes more sense than a Roman destination. Okay. Now, I know. It's like, wow, this is really getting long and boring. But I told you, I warned you about that. We can't be dogmatic on this, but if it's correct, that information is going to help us interpret the epistle. It'll help us make sense of it. In any case, we know this much for sure. Written to Greek-speaking Jewish believers who formed some type of assembly or messianic synagogue, and that's enough to go on with certainty. Finally, wrapping it up, I guess. Why was it written? Why? And we can determine that from the contents of the epistle. The epistle says, let us hold fast to our confidence. It says, let us hold fast our confession. It says, let us hold fast to the hope set before us. And it says, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. 4 different verses from 4 different places. And it says, do not harden your hearts. And it says, do not throw away your confidence. And it says, do not neglect assembling together. And it says, do not refuse him who is speaking. And it says, do not be led astray. And it says, do not be deceived. The Messianic Jewish believers to whom the Epistle of Hebrews is written are in danger of apostasy. Apostasy, a word that means falling away. They're in danger, for some reason or another, they're in danger of falling away from following after the Master. They are on the edge of forsaking their hope in Yeshua of Nazareth as the Messiah of Israel. They are in danger of forsaking the path of discipleship. All the arguments presented in this word of exhortation attempt to correct that situation by presenting the incomparable splendor of the priesthood of Yeshua. And this word of exhortation exhorts and encourages Jewish believers to remain steadfast in their commitment to Yeshua of Nazareth. And I think we can be even more specific than this. If this word of exhortation was actually composed for Jewish believers in Judea or Jerusalem in the early 60s of the first century, I think we know exactly what is going on. But we'll look at that next week. That's a whole different story. I mean, that's a story in itself. For now, consider this word of exhortation. Sounds like the type of exhortation we could use around the Messianic Jewish movement today. Unfortunately, there's a tendency toward apostasy among us. That is a tendency to fall away from the Master. A few here, a few there have denied Yeshua and turned to normative Judaism, as we know. But the far greater danger is to fall away from the Master into secularism, to fall away into the modern culture, to be absorbed by the modern spirit of agnosticism and narcissistic hedonism and materialism. That's the real threat that we face. The anti-missionaries are a boogeyman. Normative Judaism is not the threat. We shouldn't kid ourselves. It's not the problem, except in a few rare and specialized cases. The real problem that drags people away from Yeshua is the spirit of the age. Modernism, secularism. So the Epistle of Hebrews comes to exhort us and to encourage us through a period of time called the exile. Even though the epistle seems to have been written before the beginning of the Jewish war with Rome, and it certainly was written before the destruction of the temple, from a spiritual perspective, it seems as if the entire epistle was meant to prepare for these events. By teaching the priesthood of Yeshua, his sacrificial death, the temple not made with hands, and the heavenly Jerusalem, the epistle prepares us for a long, miserable exile without a priesthood, without a sacrifice, without a temple, and without Jerusalem. And by coincidence, this epistle seems to have been written only a few years, maybe seven, before that exile began, before the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, before the annulment of the priestly service, so to speak. And that is an incredible coincidence. By coincidence, my friend Grant Luton, the teaching pastor at Beth Tikkun in Ohio, happens to also be taking his congregation through the book of Hebrews. They're already up to like chapter 4. So I thought I should listen in. And I was listening to his first teaching on the book, which is very good, and he had this profound insight into the function of the epistle, the spiritual function of the epistle, and he quoted the rabbinic maxim that says, before the Holy One, blessed be He, inflicts the wound, He prepares the remedy. The epistle to the Hebrews is the remedy, teaching us and the Jewish people how to sustain ourselves in the absence of the priesthood, the sacrifices, the temple, and the holy city. Before inflicting the wound, He prepared the remedy. The epistle to the Hebrews is the remedy for the exile, and it contains within it directions for surviving and bringing the redemption. Now, none of this would have been apparent to the first readers, nor would it have been apparent to the author necessarily. But after the destruction of the temple and the fall of Jerusalem, this word of exhortation becomes so much more pertinent. In retrospect, it appears that God sent the epistle to the Hebrews, through whose hands He only knows. But it appears that He sent this epistle, as the title suggests, to the Jewish people on the eve of destruction, just prior to the longest, darkest exile that Israel has ever known. So next week, we'll learn a little bit more about the early 60s. For now, a quick review of what we just learned over the last hour. What is it? A word of exhortation. When was it written? The early 60s. Who wrote it? Someone. Someone like Clement of Rome, a Greek-speaking second-generation disciple with apostle-like authority who is part of the Pauline circle and knew Timothy and people from Italy. To whom was it written? To a Messianic Jewish assembly of believers. Maybe in Rome, maybe someplace in the diaspora, but I think in Judea, maybe in Jerusalem. Why was it written? Because the Jewish believers to whom the epistle is addressed were in danger of falling away from following the Master. And one more reason, from God's perspective, because the night of exile was about to begin, and before He inflicts the wound, the Holy One, blessed is He, provides the remedy. And the remedy is His blessed Son, who has inherited a name higher than angels, an honor higher than Moses, and a priesthood higher than Aaron's. And therefore, as we receive this word of exhortation over the coming weeks and months, our job is to hold fast our confidence and hold fast our confession and hold fast the hope that is set before us, and hold fast the confession of our hope, without wavering.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.